So Ephesians 2 verses 1 to 10 is a description of conversion, a description of what happens at conversion. And the first three verses that we considered last week set the scene according to verse 1. Prior to the point of conversion, we were dead. Not, of course, biologically dead, but dead toward God, in the grip of an addiction, we said, to trespasses and sins. According to verses 2 and 3, we were quite unable to reverse that state because of the age we were part of, and because of the devil who was ruling over us, and because of the impulses deep within us, because of all these things conspiring to keep us in that addiction, we could not bring ourselves back to life. And so the solemn theme then of those first three verses is the sheer desperate predicament that was ours prior to conversion. Our native condition was a terrible one. No ordinary remedy was going to help. No run-of-the-mill prescription was going to sort this situation out. Only something radical. Only something miraculous. Only something utterly supernatural. And what Paul now goes on to say in these verses that we're looking at is that that is exactly what happened. At conversion, God united us to his Son, Jesus Christ. He didn't simply bring us to Jesus to receive things from him, he brought us into Jesus to share things with him, to share everything with him, to share even his very resurrection power with him. In that moment of conversion, Jesus' mighty Easter Sunday resurrection kind of spilled over into our experience as well, and became part of our story as well as his story. And in that moment then, we emerged from our state of death just as surely as he on that quiet Sunday morning in Jerusalem had emerged from his state of death. That's what Paul is describing in verse 5 particularly. He says that we were made alive together with Christ. What is conversion? Conversion in Ephesians 2 is participating in Jesus' resurrection. And that's the truth then that I want us to explore together this morning in this text. Conversion as participating in Jesus' resurrection. And I want us to notice three things. First of all, the extent of this participation. The extent of this participation. Now you'll remember then that in those rousing verses at the end of Ephesians chapter 1, Paul described the sheer dimensions, if you like, of Jesus' resurrection. He brought out there that Jesus' resurrection was not merely a resurrection out of the grave. It was not merely a resurrection into the land of the living. No, Jesus' resurrection took him much further than that. It took him all the way to the heavenly places, Paul says in those verses. Jesus' resurrection was no modest thing. It was no minimalistic phenomenon. It was no small-scale thing. No, Jesus' resurrection was this mighty thing that propelled him out of the grave and all the way to the very heavenly places. If you like, we can think of it in terms of lifts. Lifts as in elevators. Perhaps you've been to the Lane Gallery in Newcastle. And if you go in there, you know, you go in initially to a little shop area at the front of the building where they sell postcards and notebooks and so on. And that shop area, to get from there to the first main floor, there are three or four steps that you have to go up. But of course, three or four steps are too many if you're in a wheelchair, if you can't walk very well. And so there is a lift, and it's a proper, fully enclosed lift to go up this little height of three or four steps. And so you go into it, it takes about a second, you hardly feel that you've moved, and you don't feel the normal sensation that you do when you're in a lift. Now, we're not to think of Jesus' resurrection in those terms, just this little thing, this little elevation out of the grave and back to life again. No, we need to go to another art gallery, we need to go to the Baltic, and we need to think of those huge glass elevators there that you get into, and they rise and rise and rise and seem to keep going at such a pace right up to the top of that enormous building. And that's a better mental image, I'm saying, for Jesus' resurrection. It was this mighty thing that took him all the way, that didn't stop until he was installed in the heavenly places. So that was Paul's point there in those final verses of chapter 1, describing Jesus' resurrection and the dimensions of it. But what we now discover here in chapter 2 and verse 6 is that when at that moment of conversion God united us to Jesus, it wasn't just a little bit of Jesus' resurrection that spilled over into our lives. It wasn't just a few sparks from Jesus' resurrection that kind of flew into our experience. But the whole thing spilled over into our experience. And we too rose at conversion like the lifts at the Baltic. We too rose and rose and rose. For us too, it didn't stop until we were installed in the heavenly places. That's what Paul says, isn't it? There in verse 6. He's talking in the past. He's not talking about something that's going to happen in the future when Jesus returns, when the world ends, anything like that. He's talking about what did happen at conversion. And he's saying then at that point we rose, and we rose with the same kind of energy with which Jesus rose from the dead, and we rose to the same height that he rose. We too, at that point, sat with him in the heavenly places. Now, of course, as soon as we say that, we immediately need to qualify it, don't we? This isn't the whole story. We saw last week, last Sunday evening, in connection with the book of Ezra, that there's a very important sense in which we are still exiles here in this world, a very real sense in which we haven't yet arrived at our final future destination. We haven't yet been enthroned with Jesus Christ in glory. We are still on that journey home. There's a very real sense in which we are absent from the Lord, as Paul puts it. Remember, we stressed in chapter 1 and verse 18 that God has called us to a hope. That he hasn't called us to this present existence that we now have as Christians, battling with temptation and sin and all the struggles and obstacles that we are presented with every day. That's not really what he called us to at all. He called us to something that we haven't yet arrived at. So there's a very important sense in which we haven't yet been installed with Christ in heaven. But nonetheless, Paul is saying that there's another sense in which we have. If we are united to Jesus, then his resurrection has spilled over, poured over, deluged over into our experience. If he has risen to the throne, we too must already, in a sense, have risen to the throne. He can't be there without us because we are joined to him. And I think we need to We need to reckon with this. We need to meditate on this far more than perhaps it's our custom to do. There was that little story in the news, wasn't there, a week or two ago, where Prince Andrew was wandering around in the grounds of Buckingham Palace and the police stopped him and were suspicious that he was some kind of intruder there. And of course he was able to put their minds at rest, and it was, as I say, an amusing story. They didn't know who Prince Andrew was in that moment. But of course Prince Andrew himself knew who he was. I wonder what, sometimes whether as Christians we don't know fully who we are. We haven't grasped just how privileged we are, the sheer dignity that God has already conferred upon us from the moment of conversion. We get up on a Monday morning and we think in these terms, we're getting up to another day of being a teacher in that stuffy classroom with all those unruly and disruptive kids to deal with all day. We're getting up to another day as an office cleaner scrubbing the floors of those toilets all morning. We're getting up to another day as a shop assistant, just replacing stuff on shelves and dealing with ratty customers. And put like that, it's not much of a day to get up to when we feel like crawling back under the covers. And of course, there's a sense in which that is what we're getting up to that morning. But Paul is saying there's another sense in which we're getting up to a day, another day of reigning with Jesus Christ in the heavenly realms. Our pupils at school may just view us as a teacher. Our employers at work may just view us as an office cleaner. Our customers at the shop may just view us as a shop assistant. But Paul is saying the angels in heaven view us as princes and princesses who already are enthroned in glory. They look upon us in awe. It takes their breath away as they look upon the sheer elevated status of you and me this morning. Because we are joined to Jesus. And already then, from the moment of conversion, in one sense, we are installed in the heavenly realms. Let's think about that. Let's view ourselves in those terms. Let's be like Prince Andrew and know who we are, even if other people don't know who we are. Let's recognize the dignity that we have in Jesus Christ. So the extent of this participation, we participate fully in Jesus' resurrection power. Secondly, this morning, the terms of this participation. The terms of this participation. Now, we know, don't we, from very recent experience that if a church is engaged in a building project, then some trust might be applied to for financial assistance, and that trust might well respond something like this: we are happy to help, but these are our terms. You must first of all raise this amount of money before we shall then come along and help you and provide this amount of money. Or perhaps you must first of all get to the point where you can start your project, where you can lay the first stones, and then we shall come along and give you some money. They will set terms like that, and of course it's perfectly reasonable and understandable for them to do so. But here's the question. Does God do that at conversion? Does he say, well, okay, I will unite you to my risen Son, Jesus Christ, and I will cause all his resurrection power to pour out into you and into your life. I will do that, but first of all, you must just come a little bit of the way. First of all, you must start just to rouse yourself from death. First of all, you must start to bring yourself to life a little bit. You must start to throw away some of those trespasses and sins in your life. You must start to clean up a bit. And if you do that, if you start to make yourself alive, then I'll come along and I'll do the rest and I'll properly bring you to life by uniting you to my Son. Are those the terms? Is that how God works? Does he want to see a little bit of movement from us first before he will then do the rest of the job and bring us fully to life in Jesus Christ? Well, the answer is, of course, no, those are not God's terms at all. Look at what Paul says there in verse 5. Even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. Not when we had already gained a bit of life. Not when we had already stirred a bit from our state of death. But when we were still utterly lifeless, dead as dodos, at that point when there was no life in us, God did it all. Those were his terms. Not you provide this amount and then I'll come along and provide the rest. But I will do it all. When you're still dead, I will convert you. I will unite you to Jesus and I will pour all the life-giving force into your experience. And that's why then Paul can only exclaim between the hyphens in our English versions here as he contemplates this. By grace you have been saved. It's a kind of outburst, I think. It's a kind of exclamation, interjection here. He just can't stop himself as he thinks about this. That it was even when we were still dead and God required no prior movement from us. It was at that point that he did this. As Paul thinks about that, all he can do is just suddenly burst out, by grace you have been saved. Grace, as we saw in connection with the early part of chapter 1, it's giving something that is utterly undeserved. There's no desert involved. There's no merit involved. There's no obligation involved. There's no response to something involved. It's just a sheer, unmerited gift. I remember being in a station in London last year, and I'd just come off a train, and I was in a rush kind of to get to the underground or something, and walked past this woman who was holding out a cereal bar. She had a bag of these things and she was holding out a cereal bar. And even though I could kind of hear her saying in my ear, free cereal bar or whatever it was, even though I could hear her saying those words, there's just that kind of instinctive reflex action, no, there must be something going on here, I'm going to avoid this woman. And then I kind of got past her, and then I suddenly kind of thought, hang on a minute, and so I turned around and went back and got the cereal bar. And that's what we're like, isn't it? Because we live in a world where you don't encounter grace. You don't encounter gifts that are just entirely free. There is always small print. There are always terms attached. And Paul is saying that here, God just did it as a gift. God converted us before there was any movement at all from us. And I think he also suggests in this text that it wasn't as if God did this reluctantly and later regretted it. You know how you can do that? You can give a free gift, but you can still do it reluctantly. So you have a nephew, and the nephew is a complete brat. And you can't stand being around him. But it's his birthday or it's Christmas and you give a present. And it's a lovely present and you spent a lot of money on it. And so it's a gift. He hasn't deserved it. He hasn't merited it. It's a gift of grace. But you're kind of doing it reluctantly. And you're doing it wishing that you didn't have to and that you never had to see him again. And Paul is saying, I think, in verse 7, that it's not like that with God. Because he says there that he did this so that in the coming ages, I think coming ages there is a different phrase, isn't it, to the age to come, because it's ages in the plural. I think it's talking about the rest of this age and then the age to come. so that in the coming ages he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness towards us in Christ Jesus. And it's this idea then of God, I think, delighting in this grace that he has shown us and wanting to show others this grace, celebrating, reveling in this grace that he has shown, that he has displayed toward us. Now, it doesn't say who he is showing this grace to, showing the immeasurable riches of his grace to. Perhaps it includes the angels. Perhaps this very morning, as we sit in this room, he's saying to his angels, look, you see that person there in NREC this morning, and that person there, and that person there. You know, they were utterly dead. Utterly dead. They didn't want me. They didn't know me. They hated me. And do you know what I did? I came along and I united them to Jesus and I brought them to life. Perhaps at this very point, he's showing the angels in heaven the immeasurable riches of his grace, pointing to us as the examples. Perhaps it means he's showing it to us ourselves. Why are we here this morning at NREC? Are we not here to be shown again by God through his Spirit, to be shown again the immeasurable riches of his grace? We've been distracted over another week in the workplace and in the home. Our minds have been befuddled by stupid television programs and by conversations that are trivial. And we've forgotten the grace of God. And we've come here again that God can show us it. That God can open the pages of his word at Ephesians 2. And say, look, this is what I did for you. You once were dead, utterly dead. There was not a breath of life in you. And I came along and I united you to Jesus Christ. God is now, throughout the remainder of this age and throughout the age to come, showcasing, exhibiting his grace. Because this isn't something that he did reluctantly. But this is something that he delights to do. We read, didn't we, in the opening text of our service this morning from Micah. He delights in steadfast love. He doesn't just practice steadfast love. Because as I said in my illustration with the nephew, you can practice love, you can practice grace without actually delighting in it. But God not only practices it, he delights in it. Grace is something that he enjoys practicing. And so I'm saying that these were the terms of our participation in Christ's resurrection power at conversion. The terms were, God did it all, we contributed nothing. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful at times, subsequently in our Christian lives, when we look at the poverty and the bankruptcy of our hearts, of our works, of our day-to-day discipleship. And we wonder whether God accepts us, and we wonder whether we are his. And we can say, well, you know, it was never on the basis of anything in me that he took me, that he claimed me. At no point did I have to show something. At no point did I have to merit his involvement in my life. If it was grace from the outset, then it's still grace today, and it will be grace until my dying breath. What a wonderful thing. By grace, you have been saved. So the extent of this participation, the terms of this participation, but then thirdly and finally, the source of this participation. So, why then did God do this? Why, at a certain point in your life, when you were still completely dead, still addicted to trespasses and sins, still shaped by the age you were part of, still controlled and dictated by the evil one, still driven by the flesh within you, why, at that moment, did God freely and graciously lavish salvation upon you through union with Jesus Christ? Why did he do it?
Well, Paul identifies in our text two things about God, doesn't he, which help to answer that question. There in verse 4. First thing about God, his sensitivity to misery. His sensitivity to misery. God being rich in mercy. Mercy in biblical parlance is generally an emotional concept. It is that pity, that sensitivity, seeing a situation of dire distress, seeing a situation of misery, seeing a situation of need. It's being moved by that. Feeling something stirring deep within you as you see that need and that distress. That's what mercy is. Something resonating within you, a chord being struck within you as you view some predicament, some plight that somebody else is in. And Paul is saying then that it's God's character to be like that. He's rich in that. He's full of pity, of sensitivity when he sees situations of distress. It's one of the wonderful truths therein that comes out in that parable, isn't it, that we read. And there you have that boy returning home from the far country. And he's thin, he's emaciated, he hasn't been eating properly for ages. He's stinking of the pig fields. He's a pathetic sight as he makes his weary way home. And as the father sets his eyes on him, we read there, Jesus says there, he was filled with compassion. Filled with compassion. Now he had reason to be deeply angry, didn't he, at this boy. He had reason to come down on that boy like a ton of bricks. He had reason to go and read the riot act to that boy. But as he saw him in his dire predicament, he was filled with compassion for him. The older brother is filled with anger. You'd have expected it perhaps to be the other way around. The brother hadn't particularly had anything done to him. He hadn't been wronged. You'd have expected the brother to exercise compassion and the father anger, but no, it's the brother anger and the father compassion. And Jesus is saying that's the character of God the Father. And Paul is saying here that's the character of God the Father. Rich in mercy. In other words, he saw you in your deadness. He saw you festering in the cesspit of your addiction to trespasses and sins. He saw you under the dictatorship and the tyranny of Satan. He saw you in that condition, and he pitied you, and he felt for you. And something within the very bowels of God, if we may speak like that, was moved by that spectacle. And that's why he graciously gave you the gift of life and brought you to life through Jesus Christ. His sensitivity to misery, and then the other thing, his devotion to us. Because that's the other thing Paul mentions, that God being rich in mercy because of the great love with which he loved us. And that's not really an explanation, is it? Because it just raises us more questions. Why does he love us? But you can't go any further back. This is kind of the bottom line. He just did love us. He just did. And that's why he gave us this free gift of life. I suppose in many respects, God's love is analogous, isn't it, to our human love. It's just on an infinitely greater scale. So our human love involves commitment
And God's love involves commitment. Our human love involves jealousy, right jealousy. And God's love involves right jealousy. Our human love involves passion, emotion. And God's love involves passion, emotion. Our human love involves action. It's not just a kind of abstract, ethereal thing. It's practiced in concrete actions. And God's love is practiced in concrete actions. So in many ways, our love is analogous to his. But there's one way in which it's different, isn't it? That in the case of our love, there's always something, at least, something lovable in the object, or something that we perceive to be lovable. There's a reason in the object of the love why we are loving that person. There's something about the person that causes us to love them. The cause is in the object, not just in us. But God's love is different. God loved us. Who's us? The us Paul's just described in verses 1 to 3. There was nothing lovable in us. As we were dead, and as we were addicted, and as we were part of this age, and as we were under the evil one, and as we were at the disposal of the whims of the flesh, there was nothing lovable about us to anybody, let alone to God, a holy God. And yet Paul says there was this great love with which he loved us, because God's love is different. God's love isn't a response to something lovable. The reason for God's love isn't in the object, it's in the lover. It's because of God that he loved us, not because of us that he loved us. That's the distinguishing feature of God's love. And as I say then, it's not, logically speaking, an explanation really. It's just an answer which raises many more questions. Why should he have loved us? We don't know, but he did. And because he loved us, he brought us to life in Jesus Christ. And really, it's just on that note then that I want us to close, not making any major practical application, because sometimes I think we should go away from texts not trying to make major practical applications. Sometimes we should go away from texts, perhaps usually we should go away from biblical texts, just adoring and praising the God we have just encountered in it. And surely that's the great thing that this text points us to. It points us to an amazing God. A God who has poured Jesus' resurrection power into our experience through union with him. A God who did this without us first doing something to impress him. And a God who did this out of mercy, sensitivity, and out of love, inexplicable love. Let's worship and praise and thank this amazing God. Amen.